Chapter 29, African Kingdoms, Gold, Salt, and Ghana. Africa was a strange and mysterious place to most Europeans. Beneath the North African coast was the Sahara Desert, a wide, barren, oven-hot stretch of earth where a traveler could be lost in a sandstorm or die of thirst in the trackless, dry wilderness. Few people crossed the Sahara Desert to find out what lay south of it. So hardly anyone knew what lay south of the desert. Because they had never seen the rest of Africa, Europeans called Africa the Dark Continent. But the northern coast of Africa and the Sahara Desert are only two small parts of Africa. The center of Africa lies between two mountain ranges, so high that their tops are always covered with snow and ice. Between these mountains, tropical rainforests grew. Hot, damp, tangled green jungle for hundreds of miles. And further south, Africa has not only jungle, but open grasslands, wide rivers, and rolling hills. In the Middle Ages, much of this land was home to nomadic tribes who roamed through the jungles and the fields, hunting and fishing, moving from place to place. These tribes did not write down their history in books or build huge cities. But in West Africa, many Africans lived in kingdoms with houses, roads, palaces, and schools. Archaeologists can see the remains of these buildings today. And these kingdoms welcomed European visitors, who wrote down descriptions of what they saw. So we know much more about these West African kingdoms than we do about the tribes who lived in the center and south of Africa. In the Middle Ages, the three largest West African kingdoms were Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. Ghana lay in the bulge on Africa's western coast. The people of Ghana lived in houses made of red clay, dried as hard as cement, and covered with roofs made out of reeds or straw. Most were farmers who grew rice, cotton, okra, pumpkins, watermelons, and sesame seeds. They kept chickens and hunted buffalo, antelope, and wild birds for meat. Each man had to serve in the army for 1 month out of every year. So they spent part of every workday making swords, shields, bows, and arrows. Craftsmen made pots, cloth, copper jewelry, and iron tools. Ghanaian iron workers were treated like magicians. They kept their ironworking skills secret so that no one knew exactly how the iron tools were made, and blacksmiths had religious rites and rituals of their own. But Ghana didn't become rich and powerful because of its iron and its pumpkins. It became rich by taxing the gold and salt that traveled through it. Europeans called Ghana the land of gold, but Ghana itself didn't have very much gold. Gold was found in the earth south of Ghana. The tribes who lived there washed grains of gold out of the soil of riverbeds and banks. They dug it out of the ground by chipping thousands of short shafts or mine tunnels into the hard earth. Each shaft might yield enough gold to make one small coin. But altogether, the shafts produced tons of gold. The West Africans made jewelry, daggers, royal ornaments, and even masks from gold. And they sold gold to the Arab merchants who lived in the north of Africa. In exchange for the gold, the Arab traders offered salt. In a hot country like Africa, the people needed to eat salt in order to stay healthy. But south of Ghana, there was very little salt in the ground. Most of Africa's salt was found in the Sahara Desert, up in the north. Slaves dug it out of the ground, working in hot, dry salt mines. These salt mines were terrible places to be. Everything was salty, the water, the food, and the ground. In the city of Tagaza, where the largest mines were located, even the houses and mosques were built out of blocks of salt, covered with camel skins. All the trees and plants had died, and there was nothing but sand and salt as far as the eye could see. Today we still say that unpleasant work is like working in the salt mines. The Arab traders brought their salt south to trade for gold, and the West African gold miners brought their gold north to trade for salt. Both the salt and the gold had to go through Ghana. So the king of Ghana charged a toll for every pound of gold and salt that went through his kingdom. Soon Ghana became very rich indeed. Eventually, Ghana grew into an empire that spread all the way out to the West African coast. It boasted an army of 200,000 archers and a huge capital city. The king lived in his own private section of the city, with the houses of his priests and wise men surrounding him. A Muslim historian named Al-Bakri visited the king of Ghana and wrote down what he saw for others to read. This is how he described the royal court. When the king invites his people to come before him and tell him about their complaints, he sits beneath a tent with his horses tethered all around it, each horse draped in gold cloth. He wears necklaces of gold, bracelets of gold, and a cloth cap woven with gold. 10 pages stand behind him, each holding a shield and a sword with a golden hilt. His noblemen sit on his right. They wear gorgeous clothes and have gold braided into their hair. The governors and city officials sit on the ground at his feet. The entrance to the tent is guarded by dogs with collars of gold and silver, and they never leave their master's presence. The kingdom of Ghana flourished for many years, but when its kings refused to convert to Islam, other African Muslims attacked its cities again and again. Ghana began to grow weaker, and the Islamic kingdom just north of Ghana, Mali, was growing stronger. Mansa Musa of Mali. When Ghana began to crumble, the kingdom of Mali, just above Ghana, took over the gold and salt trade. Like Ghana, Mali lay between the gold mines of the south and the salt mines of the north. Like Ghana, Mali made money on the gold and salt that moved along its roads, but unlike Ghana, Mali was an Islamic kingdom. Islam spread to the kingdoms of West Africa from the Muslim traders who brought salt down from the north. And although the kings of Ghana had refused to become Muslims, many other West Africans accepted the Islamic faith. The kings of Mali built schools so that their people could learn to read the Quran. They built universities so that students could discuss the important ideas of their religion, along with ideas in mathematics, history, philosophy, and science. As Mali grew, it became famous for its schools, universities, and libraries. The people of Mali had great respect for their kings. An Islamic adventurer named Ibn Battuta traveled to Mali in the Middle Ages. He described the attitude of the king's subjects like this. They submit to their king and grovel in front of him. Anyone who is summoned to see the king takes off his good clothes, puts on rags and a dirty old hat, rolls his trousers up to his knees to show his humility, and then goes in and puts his elbows on the ground. Whenever the king speaks, they all take off their turbans and hats and put them on the ground to show their respect. And if anyone asks the king a question, if the king answers him, he scoops up dust from the ground and throws it all over himself the whole time the king is speaking, just to show how unworthy he is of any answer. All Mali kings were treated with this kind of reverence, but the most famous of all Mali kings was respected not just by his own people, but by the rest of the world. His name was Mansa Musa. When Mansa Musa came to the throne of Mali, he gathered the largest army in all of West Africa. He commanded over 100,000 archers, cavalrymen, and foot soldiers. He conquered neighboring kingdoms and expanded the kingdom of Mali until, as he boasted, a traveler would need a year to travel from one end of Mali to the other. Mansa Musa was famous in West Africa, but he attracted the attention of the world when he decided to make a pilgrimage, or Hajj, to Mecca, the holy city of the Muslim faith. Every good Muslim was supposed to visit Mecca at least once during his life, but the journey all the way from West Africa to Mecca and back again would take over a year, and for all that time, Mansa Musa would have to leave his country in the hands of his advisors. But he was determined to show his devotion to Allah by making the pilgrimage. And he was equally determined to show the rest of the world that he, Mansa Musa, was one of the greatest monarchs of the Middle Ages. He decided to take his wife with him, and not just his wife, but his children and sisters, brothers, cousins, nieces, and uncles, and also his cooks, servants, bodyguards, palace advisors, soldiers, and holy men. One medieval writer claims that 60,000 people traveled to Mecca with Mansa Musa. As the caravan wound its way towards Mecca, Mansa Musa himself rode in the center of the column. 500 slaves walked in front of him, wearing robes of silk and carrying walking sticks of pure heavy gold. 100 camels followed behind, hauling 3,000 pounds of gold. Whenever Mansa Musa halted the caravan for Friday prayers, he paid to have a mosque built on the place where he stopped. When he passed through Egypt, he gave away so much gold that the price of gold plummeted. There was so much gold in Egypt that it wasn't worth as much anymore. 12 years later, the price of gold in Egypt was still low because Mansa Musa had given so much gold away to the Egyptians as he traveled through. When he arrived in Mecca, Mansa Musa took off his royal robes and his gold. Like every Muslim pilgrim, he washed himself, put on a white robe, and prayed in the holy city. He gave away alms, gifts of money, to other pilgrims and to the poor, and after he had completed his worship, he turned his caravan around and started home. But he had given away so much of his gold that he had to borrow money to get back to Mali. Mansa Musa's journey to Mecca made him famous. After his pilgrimage, medieval maps began to show the kingdom of Mali below the Sahara Desert. One of these maps shows Mansa Musa himself sitting on the throne in the middle of his kingdom, holding a golden nugget in his hand. For the first time, maps also showed roads leading from the northern African coast down into West Africa. Because of Mansa Musa, Europeans now knew all about the West African country of Mali. The Songhay Empire. The West African Empire of Ghana grew rich and powerful, but then began to fade away. Then Mali, just north of Ghana, became the richest and most powerful West African empire. But Mali, too, began to shrink after the death of the great Mansa Musa. And soon it, too, was replaced by a new empire, the Songhay. Ghana was known for salt and gold, and Mali was known for its great Islamic kings, but Songhay became known for its size. It grew and grew until it covered the land that had belonged to both Ghana and Mali. Its cities were filled with great mosques, strong-walled palaces and mansions, famous universities, and busy marketplaces where salt, iron, ivory, gold dust, and food were traded. Songhay's best-known city, Timbuktu, had 80,000 inhabitants and almost 200 schools. The medieval traveler Leo Africanus explored the land of the Songhay and wrote about his adventures. Leo was a Muslim, born in the Spanish kingdom of Granada when it was under Muslim rule. When Leo was 7, Ferdinand and Isabella conquered Granada and added it to their Christian kingdom. Most of Granada's Muslims left the country. Leo's parents took him to North Africa to live. When he grew up, Leo decided to travel from North Africa, down through the Sahara Desert, into the kingdom of the Songhay. The trip through the desert was a harsh one. Leo wrote, "Many who travel through this desert die because they cannot find water. Their carcasses lie around on the sand, scorched by the sun's heat. Others become so thirsty that they kill their camels and squeeze water out of the camel intestines and drink it. Sometimes this keeps them alive until they can find a pool or well of water." Leo Africanus made it through the Sahara Desert without having to drink water from a camel's insides. Once he arrived in the Songhay Empire, he traveled from city to city, finally arriving at Timbuktu. Here is how he described this great West African city in his book History and Description of Africa and the notable things contained therein. "The houses are made out of clay, with thatched roof, but the temple and the king's palace at the center of the city are built of stone. The city is filled with wells of sweet water, and there is much grain and many animals, so the inhabitants eat milk and butter. There is not much fruit, but there are melons, cucumbers, bread, meat, excellent pumpkins, and a huge quantity of rice. But there is not much salt because it has to be carried here from a mine 500 miles away. All of the women wear veils over their faces, except for the slave women. Many of the men are very rich, and the king himself has tremendous amounts of gold. I saw one gold bar belonging to the king, that weighed almost 1,000 pounds. The king often leads his armies into war, but only against his enemies and those who refuse to pay him tribute. In battle, he and his soldiers ride on horses that they buy from the Arabs. Their servants ride on camels. Both the horsemen and the foot soldiers shoot poisoned arrows at their enemies. But the king also honors learning and books greatly. Timbuktu is full of doctors, priests, judges, and scholars. And the king pays salaries to learned men so that they can study and teach. Books are the most valuable possession of all. They sell for more money than any other kind of goods. The people are gentle and cheerful. Every night there is singing and dancing in the streets. The people stroll continuously through the city at night, playing musical instruments. When Leo Africanus published his book, more Europeans found out about the kingdoms of West Africa. The continent was not quite so dark anymore. Europeans were startled to find out that great cities and empires existed south of the Sahara. Eventually, the Songhay Empire was destroyed by invaders who wanted to seize the salt and gold mines of the Songhay for their own. The Sultan of Morocco, in northern Africa, sent an army of 3,000 men across the desert. These Moroccan soldiers had cannons and guns, and the Songhay warriors had only spears and bows. They couldn't resist the stronger weapons of the Moroccans. The Moroccan army seized the salt mines in the north of the empire, but the Songhay refused to tell them where the gold mines lay. Finally, after more than 10 years of fighting, the Sultan of Morocco gave up on trying to find the gold mines. But the war had already torn the Songhay kingdom apart. The largest West African empire of the Middle Ages had come to an end.